to these big guys here. And I, this, he, they had big guys, said, now you keep, I'm going to give you that hill over there, and I'm going to give you that hill over there, but you stay apart now. No nonsense about getting together. I'm going to have my spies watch you. Then, but I'd like you to go fighting, and we have to fight, and people come over the hills and bother us. I'd like you around to do some fighting with you. And we go hunting together in the meantime. Now, we have, every once in a while, some of these people, those little guys, would start stealing the animals and making trouble for the strong men. So they bring in this little man and say, I'm going to cut your head off. The little man said, Mr. King, I think you made a great mistake. He said, why is that? Well, Mr. King, I understand the language of your enemy over the hill, and he's saying certain things over there that you don't know. Well, you've got quite a good idea there, young man. He would report to me every day what my enemy is saying over the hill, and your head stays on, and you're going to do something you never ever did before. You're going to eat every day. How do you like that? So then another one is going to cut their head off, and he says, Mr. King, you better not, I know about metals, and I can make you a better sword than anybody else. He said, all right, you better prove it. So he make big, beautiful swords, no question about it, about beautiful swords. Right, you make swords all the time, you do that metallurgy, and you're going to eat regularly too. And another man, he's going to cut his head off, and he said, Mr. King, you better not, because I understand arithmetic and you don't. And I've been able to steal from you very well because I knew my arithmetic. But I could use my arithmetic to see that nobody else could steal from you. You got a very good idea. So your head stays on and you eat. But you mind your business, you mind your business, you mind your business. Is that good and clear? I'm the only one who minds everybody's business? And this was the divine problem. So what he did then was to turn the people that were bright ones, that were not muscle fighters, into specialists. And then he's doing very well with his kingdom because he had the right information about his enemies and had best swords and they had best accounting and logistics. So he got a pretty big kingdom going and he has a young son and he'd like to have him take over. And he said, I see you're getting pretty old and I want you then to teach this another man about that language. I want you to teach somebody about the metallurgy, but you teach somebody about the arithmetic. And this is how our education system got going. This is the foundation of Oxford University. I said that at Oxford University, my first lecture there, and I got quite considerable applause. Because it really is so. Because then when he was afraid that these people were not going to really stay put and true, he said, I'm going to give you something I've never given anybody else. I'm going to guarantee that you eat the rest of your life. I'm going to give you tenure. So every little child demonstrates that it's interested in the whole universe. Children ask the most beautiful questions about the universe of the parents. The parents are embarrassed because they can't answer such good questions. But the child demonstrates interest in the whole, the macrocosm and the microcosm. We all demonstrate a spontaneous, with this beautifully large brain, enormous amount of information we can store, and with that mind really wanting to understand. That's what's in all of us. So when we make people specialists, we're really going quite counter to what we tend to be. If we look what's unique about human beings in relation to all the other non-living creatures, I don't know, we're somewhere between about the middle of relative size. But much more important, every other living species has some built-in unique capability. The bird has unique wings, so it can fly and fly beautifully. But when it's not flying, it can't get rid of its wings. So you see the bird trying to walk along is quite difficult. And the fish is beautiful to swimming, but it can't get walking out there on the land. We find that each one of them is designed for special capabilities and special environmental conditions. And what is unique about man is that he does not have this built-in equipment, but what he has is that beautiful mind. Ability to discover principles, by which of discovering the principles, he discovers then low pressure differential, the Bernoulli principle, and then develops the airfoil, and then he starts flying 10 times as fast as a bird. But when you're not using the wings, you take them off and somebody else can use your wings. They're interchangeable. And what's more, you're not encumbered by it. So we find then the wings will go on for the next generation or whatever it may be. This is a very different kind of a capability. And not only then is man about the middle of the sizes, but we're really in the middle of everything. That is, we are in the average, we have all this information capability, but don't have the built-in integral. And we then develop tools, and these tools are really a part of you and I. They're only in the universe by, as part of you and I. Just exactly as a bird's nest is part of a bird. The oriole has a very special kind of nest, that's part of an oriole. And the web is part of a spider. That is, many of the species have this dissociated secondary part of the ecological survival equipment. So you don't all have to have an integral at all. And human beings simply have this very much more. So we're really right in the middle of things. And that's an extent that's very important if you think about what I'm saying, because our experience is omnidirectional. Being the middle, you can't really improve on the middle. When people talk to me about the possibility of genetic experimentation of trying to make a better human being, you might build in some wings onto him, but he's not going to be a better human being. He's going to just be good at flying and going to be no good at other things. And what we do develop in the way of, when we do develop the specialization, we do it by inbreeding and outbreeding general adaptability. That's exactly what happens. And it'd be very easy to breed from man to ape by breeding out general adaptability. We have no suggestion of any other kind of capability. So when I begin to think about this human being on board of our planet with this extraordinary mind, and trying to think about where you and I are today, again, we can also note that we are the most complex organism we know to exist in the universe in terms of the 92 regenerative chemical elements, the number that will be present in our organism, or inhibitable by us, or take in and to advantage the way of trace elements in our food. There's no known organism in the universe so complex as man, save the universe itself. We almost seem to be a miniature kind of universe. Now, supposing you were trying to invent another thing about those generalized principles I spoke to you about. If you're not a specialist, specialists then tend to find maybe one generalized principle that they're particularly interested in their field. They may not even find any. The social sciences have not as yet found any generalized principles, with all the people been at it. And so that when you get to really looking, as you become a generalist, and look at the inventory of the now well-established generalized principles, you find most unique about them is that none of them contradict another one. Not only do they not contradict one another, but all of them are inter-accommodative. And then many of them inter-accommodative at exponential rates of inter-augmentation. Where you then have a complex, a weightless, generalized principles, eternal principles, that are inter-accommodative. When you say that, I say a design is a complex of inter-accommodation. That's what I mean by design. The universe is apparently a very extraordinary design of these complex principles, no confusion one between the other. And we have human mind then having some access to this eternal, extraordinary design, very meager though it may be. Now I begin to wonder why you and I might be in the universe in this very complex phenomenon, even though we are tiny on this little planet. By virtue of having the mind and able to discover principles, and discovering, for instance, then electromagnetic waves. Never mind how he stumbles on it, the point is he does discover it. He discovers that they're what we call colors are just simply waves, and their frequencies, we have the tuning capability. We have a little special crystal set, uses red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. What man called reality up to this century was everything you could see, smell, touch, and hear. And knew nothing about electromagnetic spectrum. We did have man gradually going from that pharaoh time, and incidentally I seem sometimes to jump back and forth weaving here, but going back to that pharaoh time, where we then everybody's doing everything for the afterlife of the pharaoh, it was then the Leonardo, the architect of the time, was chosen by the pharaoh to design the pyramid, who then recognized the principle of the lever and then got the man using to move that rock around, and recognizing that many of his workers were starving, not having enough energy to do their work, he saw the Nile there, and rather the Nile was all everything was green alongside of it. He said, I've had the water gets too, apparently it goes green, so he invented making some irrigation ditch and found, sure enough, the green spread, they could feed more people. And he did various things like that. What we would call in building the pyramid, he did a number of scaffolding tasks. They're make-readies, make-ready tools. And when the Pharaoh died, and they threw the architect into the tomb with him so he could get there afterward a little faster, with a great privilege, the tools were still there. The people who had been using them were still around. So they didn't get lost. We then have an accumulation gradually of more and more know-how and experience. Pretty soon there's so much know-how and experience that, you know, we not only take care of the afterlife of the Pharaoh, but we could take care of the afterlife of the nobles. That began a new set of dynasties of Egypt. Then gradually the accumulation of know-how really multiplies now if you take care of all the nobles too. So there's so much accumulation of know-how that the son said we could take care of the afterlife of all the middle class. That's beginning by Greek and Roman history. When you see the well-to-do middle class having them special mausoleums and so on. Gradually there's such accumulation of know-how as well becomes really evident. And this is the time of the great prophets of first the Buddha and then Christ and Muhammad, when he said, you know, we could take care of the afterlife for everybody. And that is the beginning really what we call the Christian era, where you have then the beautiful great cathedrals being built where everybody's getting ready for that. Everybody's now in on the afterlife directly. But this in the cathedral building and so forth, you'd learn much more technology and so forth. So suddenly there's so much technology that said, no, we could take care of the afterlife of everybody and the living life of the king. That was the divine right of king's time. Then the technology accumulated more and more, said we could take care of the afterlife of everybody and the living life of the king and the nobles. And that's the Magna Carta time, very recent. Then there's such accumulation of the technology that said, you know, we take care of the afterlife of everybody and the king and the nobles and the middle class. And that's the great Victorian era. That goes right up to the early buildings you find here in Portland. Then came a fantastic moment when we really said, now we really know enough, so we take care of the afterlife and the living life of everybody. And that's the one we're really in. And when I was young, I'd gone through seeing man really generally very illiterate in really enormous want. Since the turn of the century, we've gone from less than 1% of humanity to about 40. We're now up to, for this, as 1972, we've got to 50% of humanity enjoying a higher standard of living than was known to any king before the 20th century. It's a extraordinary matter. And that's all just happened like that, in this new flume. And it's working that curve towards 200 AD, where everybody would be in. What seemed to me the most critical moment in history, but up to the turn of the century, less than 1% had any such success. And you had everybody in want, the revolution could happen any time, very easy to get up. But as you began to have affluence, what's going on, then the multiplication of affluence is all the more irritating the have-nots. And what seemed to be quite clearly predictable quite a few years ago was, as we went through the 50% point, be the point where the majority, when it's still majority is 51% and 49% of affluence, you'd have the most irritating condition you could possibly have. Possibility of man really blowing himself up, not realizing that this kind of a curve is taking place. I said, we haven't really realized that wealth really is accumulating, and that this would be the most dangerous year. So I predicted 1972 would be the most critical year of man on the planet. From there on, the majority of it has for the first time in history, and they realized they couldn't possibly enjoy their haveness without really with the remaining have-notness. And so this would be a great acceleration rate which we really would come to change these things. Now, and I digress from talking about the generalized principles to go back to that Pharaoh. I want to bring a point where we've gone from then reality of everything that was something you smell, touch, and see, and touch, and hear, to suddenly in came the great electromagnetic spectrum. The radio, World War I, X-rays, all such things. 1930, which again is no time at all ago, 1930, for the first time in history, man published the great electromagnetic chart, electromagnetic spectrum. Because in the meantime, learning about frequencies and so forth, they discovered that each chemical element had unique frequencies. It's very extraordinary matter that little man on a tiny little planet, with his beautiful mind discovering those principles, has been able then to just take the light from any observed stars and tell exactly what chemical elements are involved in that star. Now, a little tiny man on this planet literally has an inventory of all the chemical elements present in the observed universe. Tiny as we are able then really to get some very, very important information in that beautiful mind. Now, in view then of our tininess and the power of that mind, and that we are on our planet and so forth, and we're going through a strange transition. Now, for the first time, really what's going on in this room is we are really all here, it's all of us. And up to the time of the Victorian era, we have the artists then making end products, one off, for the great patrons. But suddenly, when it has to be for everybody, they're not enough artists. So the artists then begin making the tools, and we have energy being put on the ends of the levers so that the tools make for the many, and the artists.